This is the panel discussion at Eli 2015 in Riyadh. I'm Stephen Downs.
Yeah. Then The innovation that has taken place in our field has been disruptive because it has changed their situation from not being able to access an education to being able to access an education. And I think that this will have longer-term social implications, but it's funny because we still see the traditional university and the traditional publisher going along with a lot of things happening.
My understanding of innovation, most people don't necessarily understand what that means. I think that idea originated in regards to the situation that might call that the cheaper or more companies are for sure, right? From that perspective, it's a digital model, it's a digital program that originates from the digital world. And even though that's how historical innovation became characterized, I think what my mind what constitutes innovation, first of all, is also the idea
if
people, for instance, we talked a lot about taking an existing practice and just putting it out there. Would that be disruptive? No. To have some impact, more people more people might probably have access to more qualification. But if you really look at it and say, look, I can rethink how I teach, I can rethink how learners engage in this, then online education can be disruptive. If institutions, existing institutions, newer kinds of institutions are willing to step back and say, look, I really need to think about this whole phenomenon as a way of addressing access issues, learning issues that I have just asked us about, then because of the opportunities that online affords, then it could be disruptive. But it means having to rethink a lot. It means having to rethink who's teaching, the spaces in your institution. It also means having to rethink your financial models. A lot of it, because when you think about online and disruptive, you have to think about the fact that many of these things that we are looking at as very, very interesting, potent experiments are at best that they are potent experiments. Which means that for their long-term impact, you need a sustained commitment of interest, a sustained commitment of resources to see if this is really going to change. Then you can say that it can be disruptive. Quick comment, my old boss was a provost at MIT, and he became the president of BU. No wonder we were thinking about all kinds of interesting education technology things we had done with Microsoft Research and open course of technology. And he says, on reflection, it almost looks like we had a strategy. So what I'm saying is, in reflection, online education could be disruptive. A lot of things here.
And then the second one is about books, DC books, and the sort of education.
Well, that's an interesting question. And it ties in with the remarks just completed. And I have to say, when I speak to books, I speak to the thing that we developed for students and myself, and not the things that were developed in Norway from Sarah and Master and others. Because they are basically a reversion to the original model. And the big thing that George Siemens and I did, along with our colleagues, was to, if you will, change the ownership of the means of production of the course. And that's the sort of thing that could be disruptive. In the sense that PJ has mentioned. Because, it's interesting. Much of the work, including things like open courseware and so on, and even edX and Coursera, continue to base the locus of production and learning in the institution, and in particular, the university, and even more in particular, in the case of Coursera. The elite institutions like Stanford, Harvard, MIT, and the rest. But George Siemens, David Cornier, and I, and some others, come from not so elite institutions. George and I both worked in Manitoba, which is a province in Canada characterized mostly by being flat and very rural, and creators of some of the world's best wheat. And not an elite institution. But we created this form of the MOOC because we wanted to change the idea that learning is something that flows from the elite institutions to the masses below to something that people create for themselves. And so that's why we established a network structure for our course, and we established mechanisms whereby everybody participating in the course could contribute to the offering of the course, or to the bringing in of materials for the course, or the defining of the curriculum of the course. This Dave Cormier says even of the outcome of the course, you, as the learner, decide what constitutes success in the course. And just as an aside, that sort of makes a match with the idea of best practices and evaluating your course as a whole for success. If you have multiple definitions of success, you know, what is the success of a state? Well, let's do some tasks and measure concepts of serving. So, in that sense, I think that these books are disruptive. And I think that, yeah, it's still early days, but I think they have established not simply the potential for being disruptive, but I think that they are disruptive. Nietzsche raised the question of, you know, sustaining dedication and finance and all that. These books don't require that. They don't require institutional investment. They don't require the overhead. All they require is a population and the means of connecting that population. And then the rest of it is a concept. And the concept of open education itself, open education as organized by the people who are learning from this education, I think is a very disruptive change. And I think one that will impact has indeed already impacted even the leading institutions like Stanford and MIT and Harvard.
To talk about my education or books and stuff.
Or books. I think Stephen's made a great point talking about open education itself as being disruptive. So I just wanted to recognize that. But I was just going to go back to the original question whether online education is a disruptive innovation. And I'd like to think, I guess I'm prepared to think of the question as if online education is a significant innovation. And for that question, I would start by wondering, is it significant to whom? To society, to individuals, who are we? And online education itself, I would say that it is a significant innovation, but within that, there are significant innovations as well. So there's technology, there's practices, there's pedagogies, the idea of education, like Stephen mentioned, that exists within online education. Or even the idea that we have seen both from Stephen's work and from the more traditional work that is happening, that we can build platforms that allow us to study learning in different ways that we have in the past. So I think the idea of studying learning as the ultimate innovation by itself. So then we take another step back and think about online education. We tend to think of that particular thing or something like open education, so the idea. We tend to think of those as innovations that happen in kind of a vacuum. But we need to consider kind of the environment that these things are coming. The environment in which they're
I was just reminded when Tata started to open technology and open online infrastructure. I remember a meeting I was having several years ago when we were thinking the mobile devices are coming, looking at conversion technologies, and I was having a planning meeting at MIT. And Bob Metcalf, who normally say was the father of the internet, so Bob Metcalf was there, and he says, you know, he was talking about the difficulty of adoption of these technologies. And he says, you know, very often when we introduce a new technology or an innovation, initially our tendency is to continue to do old things in old ways. Then after a substantial amount of time, we do start doing old things in new ways. But he says the real magic happens when we start doing new things in new ways. And this is sort of speaks to Stephen's comment about both CMOOCs and, you know, really looking to see if you think about this whole business of teaching, learning, educating lots of people in interesting new ways. And I think that I would attach the term disruption to those, to the time or to a situation where you start in education doing new things in new ways. Right now, there is a lot of my life is connected to open education. And one of the things we have a common colleague, a good friend, David Wiley, who always reminds us that when we talk about open, he will talk about the four R's, that you should be able to reuse resources, should be able to revise resources, re-edit resources, and redistribute resources. So many of these initiatives are open, but, you know, sort of open in a gratuitous way, or in a because you can see but you can't touch a lot of stuff, which is not bad. Access is not a bad thing from internet at all. So, you know, where you are now determines a lot about success. So for people who have no access at all to be able to see and model, it's good, but it's not good enough. We are more interested in meaningful access. So there's a project that I made a small reference to this morning that we are engaged in right now. This is with underserved schools in India, and particularly 70% of the schools in rural areas. And we are looking at both open resources and making everything that we produce out of this openly available. But we're looking at a platform like MITx, looking at lots of educational technology enablements, and creating curriculum elements, working with teachers and institutions over there, creating curriculum elements for science, math, English. But again, mind you, the target of application is underserved schools in India. So the pilot state involves 900 students. And the ambition over there is to really do high quality open education. So all the things that we see as the benefits of openness, communities working with each other, individuals working with each other, content being shared, practices being shared. So that is not a goal. So in fact, scale is not a goal we are trying to achieve. Scale is an input in how we want to do quality education. And we want to use that as a trickle up. So we want to work with these schools, develop exciting curricula, share it so that it becomes a model for how all your education can happen, the trickle up. Now, if that for me shows how the notion of openness as enabled by technology, by current digital affordances, can really be impactful, can really be
useful. Thank you. Do you see this as an opportunity for universities, for press, or are universities in trouble? They don't keep doing the same thing?
Well, I've been in and around universities for the last, I don't know, 30 years. Universities are always in trouble. I've never known a
their time, the universities are not in trouble. So, I find that very interesting, an interesting question. I think there is a role, and let me be really clear about this. We talk about universities as well as some sort of monolithic thing, but they're not. I think that there is a very important role for a publicly funded educational institution to provide a basic level of support and resources into a learning network in a society. Now that's a very different mission from what universities have right now. Universities right now have the mission of offering a relatively elite level of education to a relatively elite level of students. And I think that this mandate is going to be shifting to providing a relatively high level of loosely described knowledge products or learning products, I don't even like the word products, but I'll use it, to the population as a whole. So the segmentation of the market between university and non-university will probably, as a result of open learning, be eliminated. But I think we need to understand that the change universities will be facing will be the change from being the gatekeepers, the sustainers, and providers of learning, and even the edX model in India is sustainers, gatekeepers, and providers of learning. They will change from being a source of input into learning, but the locus of learning itself will move away from these institutions. And that will allow them to focus on what they really wanted to do all along anyway, which is research.
I agree with you that the universities are always kind of trouble, but they're always changing as well. And one of the stories that we're told, that the universities have been static since the dawn of time, and that you walk into your classroom and you feel comfortable because the classroom is the same as you walk into your teacher room, which is not the case. I think, though, that when, even though they are in trouble, I think it is a time where opportunity for universities shines. It's a time where universities are, it's a time where there's so much interest in online education, in particular digital education, or whatever term you prefer to use, that I think institutions have a real opportunity to rethink the work that they do, either in models, you know, that students subscribe to, or in other ways. In thinking about bringing communities together, in thinking about providing different experiences to different people, I don't like the word theater that reduces, it reduces the work that a lot of people do. So I think, to summarize, yes, they're in trouble, but they're also
improving. Would you like to ask about how do you see the futures?
Well, I tell you, so one of the things I mentioned that this program, a doctoral program, this future studies program, this was at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and we used to have a sign on the door, which said that, about futures, and that the business of the futures was to make future possibilities more real for others. So the intent was not to forecast or predict, but to create. So, and we actually believe that, and as they are doing, you know, in various ways, with countering opinions, different models, the, you know, whether it is a MOOC model or this, you know, this, what we are doing is trying to look and do combinations of different resources on hand, you know, from the supply side to meet what we think are emerging demands for education of different kinds of people and get more and more people. So how do I see the future? I see one thing, and, you know, which is that the tendency for institutions, existing institutions, the tendency for countries to look at change seriously has become better, or they're becoming more, I shouldn't say welcoming of change, but more non-resistant to change. One of the things I see are institutions, and maybe this is because everyone is challenged. When MOOCs happened, a lot of small colleges in the U.S. are wondering about their survival and so on. They stay like the brothers. But I think one of the changes that has happened, and I'm going to credit the open movement significantly with that, and certainly networks of technology, is that there's a significant change towards demand pull. So people, you can't just say supply side, we have this, you take this. More and more people are engaged. So there is considerable demand pull from different kinds of models, different kinds of sectors, which is really making existing institutions think about change in a much more, again, not welcoming way, but in a much more sort of accepting way. So one of the things that I see for in the future is institutions actually really beginning to look, it's still small, but look seriously at how they are teaching, what they are doing in the first place. Perhaps driven by the need for survival, there are much, okay, that's one thing. I'm also seeing, as a result of, as part of this whole willingness to look at change, a greater tendency for institutions to collaborate or at least to cooperate in offerings. And this is becoming clear. We're seeing a lot of international partnerships, albeit it's in the same form of education, production, and delivery. You're seeing many more international partnerships, institutions across different countries and different continents working together, because either to preserve their market share or actually believing that there is opportunity, symbiotic opportunity, synergy, some synergy to be had through these kinds of partnerships. So there's much more, I certainly see much more boundarylessness happening between education sectors and between education institutions. Again, as a result of some of this demand pull that is coming from industry or from the general populace, I see that there is much greater tendency, this is at a much more granular level, to bring relevance into curriculum. So that people talk about courses, you know, people again look at courses and modules and offerings and try to link them much more conspicuously and consciously to needs in the marketplace or skills in the marketplace. So I see things like that happening, and the opportunity to do that being much more pronounced than it was before.
Do you know where I'm going?
Yeah, that was fascinating. Many messages and many layers in that remark, or that set of remarks. And I had different thoughts as it went through them. One thought I had, and this is a bit facetious, so take it with a grain of salt, but one of the thoughts I had in the middle is that the guy from MIT is asked first all the time,
But think of some of the things that were said there. One thread was, there were layers of meaning. I wish I could take the transcript and do the deconstruction of it. So many layers of meaning in it. One thread in there about changing, you know, what will the future be if it will be what we create. Another thread about not wanting to resist change. And there were more threads. But let me think about those for one thing. Let me talk about resisting change first. Because people urge me to accept change, it's almost ironic because I'm a watching the instantiation of change. But generally when you say, you should accept change, what they mean is, we are going to take your money and we want you to accept that. And there goes my pension fund, or my salary is cut, or I lose my job. So, you know, there are very good reasons to resist change. It's not all change is good. And this is especially the case with another thread with the whole market-driven model for business and education. And we see that change sweeping our own society as well. Using our educational institutions, government services, businesses, etc. But what adopting a market-driven approach does means is doing whatever people who have money tell you to do. And viewed that way, that kind of change is not for nothing. And I see this a lot. Like I saw it even in the second talk that I saw today. I'm afraid I can get his name. But they did a survey of students, and the result of the survey of students was that education should not embrace social media. But the survey was of relatively high-level successful students in German educational institutions. And of course they're going to say, this is what you should do. And of course that's what educational institutions are going to do, because those are the people who have the money to pay for the education. And I get this from especially from people from Harvard, from Stanford, from Berkeley. They talk to their students, say such and such, so that's what they're going to do. Agency change. And there's this supposition that change, that the future really is what one person can make or what one institution can make. There's this picture of the expert or the great man or the great institution going forth into the world and making it right. And I've never seen that model work, ever. Because it's a misunderstanding of how the future is created. And it's a misunderstanding of the future itself, the nature of the future itself. Because the future isn't simply a simple set of causes and effects. There was another talk before we talked about, we measure the impact of our educational intervention and find out the outcome by that established best practices. But as people who actually study science and research were studying, this is a ridiculous model. That's not how it works. So how does it work? I've written many times, too many times, I'm sorry, that the way we learn about the future is the way we learn about the past. It's the same process, and it's the way we learn about the forest, and in this case, the desert, and society around us. We look at it, and we see the signs, we see the regularities, we watch the ebbs and flows, we see a chaotic environment, and we see transitory patterns in that environment. And as Douglas Rushkoff wrote a decade or so ago, you catch a wave and you ride a wave. You catch a train, you see a pattern. But you know that you're not actually capturing the whole, as we call the Newman, right? There is a reality out maybe we can impact, that maybe we can affect. But the future will be the total consequence of all actions and all forces in the universe, including the weather, including the climate, including the environment, including the price of wheat, and including whether Johnny Newton wants to study mathematics, even if he's been told it's good for him. And you can't just go in and change that. And it's not a question of simply accepting whether what somebody says to you is going to happen inevitably. I mean, it's our obligation to live in a chaotic world, knowing on the one hand that we cannot control what happens in that world, and knowing on the other hand that we have to make our way in that world and not surrender what is ours and what we believe properly belongs to us.
Thank you, George.
I'd like to talk about folks who are sharing, I suppose, how much we talk about that. I hope and aspire that in thinking about futures and taking active steps to create futures, we involve people from all sorts of backgrounds in that design. There is a tendency, there are certain cultures in Silicon Valley to develop approaches for people based on narrow perspectives of the world, and I think that involving different groups would be beneficial for us all. The second item that I want to talk about that I guess makes me hopeful comes from a recent study that we did, and it relates to collaboration, like Jim mentioned, and it relates to people studying education from different perspectives. So, just to summarize what we did, we basically took all the literature that had been published on MOOCs between 2003 and 2005, and we looked at all the disciplines of the authors who wrote about MOOCs. And we then compared, we created sort of an index that looks at the diversity of the disciplines, and compared that to all the authors that wrote about books between the years of 2008 and 2012. Again, the samples have some issues, but those are the samples that we did at that time. And what that comparison showed is that more people from more different disciplines are doing some of these studies, and we think that is, we hope that is helpful for the design of future systems. So that might be helpful. I'll stop there.
Thank you, John. The last question, and start this question by asking Steve. And then we leave the humanity guy to the last more time to think about. How should we react as an education, let's say, university president or education leader ask you, what do you suggest as your recommendation? What should we do?
So I have created change. I feel good that my job here is done. The one single piece of advice I would give to educational leaders working in educational institutions, and it might sound heretical, but you should stop thinking of your institution as more important than the students that you serve or the society in which you work. And this advice comes from maybe hundreds of presentations that I see and dialogues and discussions where the core and the center of what the presenter presents is what our institution is doing and how our institution is adopting this program or doing that or whatever. And when pushed, when we talked about, you know, how things will impact the future, they answer from the perspective of their institution. And I get that. I get that people feel that it's a responsibility to speak from the institutional perspective because they believe that they are representing the institution. But the institution itself needs to stop seeing itself from the institutional perspective. And to see it, I'm not sure exactly what, but to see it from multiple perspectives, to see itself as seen from, to see itself, even more importantly, as seen from the perspective of a student who would like to go there but who cannot, for whatever reason. As seen from the perspective of the person who works all day as a plumber and spends a certain amount of their salary supporting that institution, either directly through public education funding or indirectly through grants and other allocations that eventually go to the institution. These are perceptions, these are points of view that are hard for institutions. But I think that the more that they should take on these diverse points of view and embrace them as their own, the better institutions will be to meet the challenges of the future.
So, there there is a lot to be learned and understood. And so I would really encourage the advisors to experiment and to be willing to learn from the experiment. So the corollary to this being willing to experiment and all that goes along with it is to be willing to disrupt yourself. Because there are things that you might find out. For instance, one of the things that we might find out is that there is no one future. In fact, we keep talking about preferred futures. There might be options to the future of the institution, which might not, you know, which might take the institution to a place where it doesn't look anything like it is now. So, experiments, large experiments, being open to the notion of disrupting oneself. These are easy statements to make, not easy statements to plan. And but to the notion that there are preferred futures, there are different options, depending on who you become. But in all this, and I was making a reference to this morning, one of the things that I do believe is important is as we go through this experiment, change, bringing new kinds of practices, we have to keep having this conversation about what is it that we value, and it might not be the same as some other institution values, but we really have to think about what are our core values of our institution? Are there a set of things that we believe in terms of teaching and learning practice that we think are very important for learning that we want to hold on to as invariants, perhaps recapitulate them in terms of new resources, but really think hard about what is the idea is not to throw away everything, but really think hard about what is it that we value and how can that be reinterpreted, recontextualized in the current form. So again, so it's about experiments, it's about being willing to disrupt ourselves and to be open to the notion of preferred futures with a sharp focus on thinking about what is it that we really value.
Thank you. I have time for questions. I'll start from here.
Thank you very much for this valuable presentation. From the qualitative perspective, we talk about the needs and desires of the customers. And we talk about the internal customer and the external customer for this organization. Are the universities meeting the needs of the society now and the needs of the students and measuring these things from your experience? I like what the students said, we need to look from the perspective of the students. Are we really providing valuable services for them? Are we creating for them a good future? So, what do you think from these universities should do to meet the customer desires and needs?
I'll answer from my own personal perspective. Since I think it's relevant. In 1980, I was qualified to work in restaurants. I wasn't even qualified to do that. That's where I worked. Mostly washing dishes, sometimes waiting tables. And that's what I was going to be able to do all my life. I moved to the province of Alberta, Canada, and I was given access to a university, the University of Calgary. And it was a long and winding process, but eventually they gave me some degrees in philosophy. And they also put a sign on the side of the wall for all philosophy students to read. It said, "You are studying philosophy. Do not expect to get a career or even a job as a result of your studies here." And so I did not. As it turns out, I did get a job based on my studies. But more importantly, the university served me in providing me what I really wanted,
which was, you know, the capacity to think, the capacity to reason, to see the world, a broader kind of world than the world of kitchen and dishwashers and dirty plates and stuff like that, and to be able to create my own future. And the reason why so the University of Calgary, in that case, did very much meet the need of its student. But I'm a special case. And I think everybody is a special case. And so it's hard to answer a question like that because every single person going to university has a different need. Some of them want answers to specific questions. Others of them want to impress their parents. Others of them want to get a degree. By and large, universities probably satisfy these needs. Where I think the real question is do the universities satisfy the needs of the wider society that they serve? Do they serve the needs of people who do not actually attend the university? And I think the answer to that question is broadly, no, they do not.
Well, taking a personal opinion, it comes down to success. So one of the things that, I wrote for the management. In the beginning of this book, simply said I worked with my institution to give me data so that I could show the value of quantitative models for education plan. This is the late 70s and 80s. Then you land with future studies in education. Social structures of education. And I remember a statement that one of my faculty members made, which struck me when he was writing a recommendation. He said, we encourage our students to stick their neck out. So success meant that you enable your students to take chances, to pick a set of learnings, and go apply where their interest to them or where necessary to them, because it was also about for some people, it might be about getting jobs. Now, when we look at it's creating that empowerment, not just through content, through knowledge, but the confidence that you can take on a changing world, which it is. So, I think when we talk about success, it is not, Stephen was making reference to the market-driven. I really want to think generously about the market. The market is something that's today. The market may be something that's tomorrow. So the market is a proxy for changing life conditions, needs that you can either apply what you know now or have the capabilities to equip yourself. We talk about continuous education, being able to come equip yourself when conditions are being changed so that you can respond to it. And in that sense, I think I think many institutions will do a good job, but now I can speak to MIT, and one of the things that we noticed, and this is a very important facet about the demand, pull, populous, learner-driven educational model that we're getting into, because we are not creating or equipping our learners to go take jobs. In the world as it is evolving, we are equipping our learners to go make jobs, create jobs. In fact, one of the statistics that we started looking at now is how many of our students are actually going as entrepreneurs of different types. And so, and they come back for change. I noticed that so many of our alums come and take these courses because they want to retool themselves. So I think we are being somewhat successful in creating those kinds of capabilities, but I think we have to focus not only on the immediate, but on creating the capacity for them to change and learn and help themselves much more downstream.
Thank you. One more last question from Lady Sad. Do you have any question? Khawat?
Usaram diferenças bastante
diferentes. Uma linha de intervenção. Eu quero perguntar se você tem algum ponto para a universidade de frustração. There is a moment when the students are able to accept the products or whatever the music is music with them near their home or whatever. But there's a problem with the professor that they are not cooperate to use that and many of our universities, especially the government universities, I think. And I think they have to have an idea of the administration, not the professor, not the whole staff, not the whole structures or whatever, but I think there is a need to have to check what why you are not using what you are using in their teaching in the universities. So I might have a question on the session, how to get your
Okay.
Sure. I'm going to repeat the question to make sure that I understood it correctly. The question was about how do you encourage faculty members to do various things that are deemed to be valuable. You kind of go through your own career. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. I always enjoy talking about faculty members because it's an interesting group. I now have faculty members, but I think faculty could be avoided. But one piece of advice that I would give to help encourage people try new technologies, for example, is to get people to work with peers. It's often difficult for someone from the administration, for example, to come and say, you should do X, Y, and Z, but the immediate reaction from the faculty member would be, no, I'm not going to do that. But faculty members, in my experience, in the two institutions that I've been at, is that advice and information from peers who have tried something and have been successful works really well in encouraging people to take risks or try out new things. Something else that universities could do is rethink the structures and incentives and disincentives that they have in place for faculty members to engage in various activities. Because if you are encouraging or if you're rewarding a faculty member by the research that they're doing, and then you're coming and saying, oh, you should be trying out more things in your teaching, you should be spending time on that, you're providing mixed messages. So figure out what it is that you're wanting to encourage people towards, and figure out how you can do that. And those two pieces of advice, I think, are helpful to start.
Thank you, George, Stephen. We enjoy this. Thank you very much. Thank you,
everyone. Oh no, it's failed completely.